Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. From calls for unity to warnings about the U.S. southern border to touting the strong American economy, President Donald Trump gave a 90-minute State of the Union address last night to Congress and the nation. Today in The Exchange, we gauge your reaction to the speech, and we'll hear Granite State voices, including the leaders of the New Hampshire Young Republicans and Young Democrats. So let's hear from you now. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Andy Smith, director of the UNH Survey Center, the state's leading polling organization. He's also an associate professor of practice in political science at UNH. Andy, thank you very much for making the time.
Happy to be here.
Also with us, Chris Galdieri. He's an associate professor of politics at St. Anselm College. And Chris, thank you also for being here. Late night for everybody. Thank
you. Glad to be here, Laura. Thank you.
Again, our number here in The Exchange for you to join us with your reactions and thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. And in addition to hearing from the Young Republicans and Young Democrats, and you, will be playing lots of clips from the speech itself, including some clips from the Democratic response. So, gentlemen, big themes of the speech, and then we'll go through them piece by piece. And Andy Smith, you first. What were the two or three main themes that just jumped out at you?
Well, I think the first main theme that he's tried to strike early on was a bipartisanship, a sense of unity coming together. And I think that the rest of the speech probably veered away from that in the eyes of many Democrats. So I think that that was certainly an overall thing. The other thing I think was emphasis again on the border wall and pushing for that. That was, I think, very expected, using this opportunity to push his desire to have a border wall. So I think there were a lot of other specific things in there. I guess another theme would be that it was less of a laundry list than is typically the case in most States of the Union addresses, where it's usually just a litany of thing after thing after thing that either has been accomplished or you hope to accomplish in the next year. So it was a little less boring in that sense.
Well, and there was a lot of talk beforehand from the White House about the big theme of the speech was going to be, as you said, Andy, bipartisanship. So let's just hear a little bit about what President Trump said. Lawmakers of different parties, he said, should come together for the benefit of the whole country.
But we must reject the politics of revenge, resistance, and retribution, and embrace the boundless potential of cooperation, compromise, and the common good.
So, Chris Galdieri, what do you make of that, especially politics of revenge and resistance? Because people who really don't like Donald Trump have those resistance bumper stickers on their cars.
That's right. And it was sort of an odd note to hear from Trump. His entire political persona has been one about, conflict and, keeping fights open because he thinks they're better for him politically than compromising to resolve them. It did seem, though, when he's saying we need to get away from resistance and we can't have these investigations because we need unity, a very particular definition of unity that involves not criticizing Donald Trump, not investigating his businesses and campaign and administration and so on.
Go ahead, Andy.
No, I agree that the call for unity, I think, fell flat on Democratic ears because the number of the things that he pushed afterwards were certainly things that they would see as unity in the sense that it was Trump's unity, not bipartisan unity.
Again, our number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange at nhpr.org. Chris, so Andy mentioned big themes, bipartisanship and the wall. And certainly I did a rough clock and those definitely took up the bulk of the time. But what else jumped out at you in terms of themes from this speech, Chris?
Well, I mean, overall, it was just such a split personality speech. On the one hand, you had this call for unity followed by describing the border crisis in the most, you know, apocalyptic terms imaginable. And then he swiveled into this part where he offered congratulations to the Democrats and particularly Democratic women who got elected. And then he switches to this, red meat rhetoric on social issues, abortion, socialism. And so it was really just sort of all over the place. And I think it shows what a difficult political position Trump is in right now. His party has lost the House. He's actually facing Democrats who have subpoena power, who have investigatory power. And I don't think that the White House has figured out really how to deal with that yet on an ongoing basis. And then you've got the looming specter of 2020. How does Trump get reelected with his poll numbers where they are with Mueller and various congressional investigations hanging over him. I mean, they're in a really tough spot, and I don't think they figured out how to get out of it.
A split personality speech. Wow. What do you think, Andy?
Well, I think there was certainly an aspect to that, but one of the things that I got a kick out of was when, as soon as he was going towards really saying things that are going to antagonize Democrats, where their faces were really getting sour. Then he'd throw him a bone, like the
paid family leave
was in there. All of the women that were elected. So he had these things that were seemingly keeping Democrats off balance in the audience. I don't know if that's necessarily a good strategy for the people at home, who I guess is the idea of trying to reach with these sorts of speeches. But he was keeping Democrats off balance in the room. They didn't know whether they should stand up or not sometimes, I think.
Well, and talking about what Chris mentioned, describing the border, the situation there in sort of apocalyptic terms, the president did spend, I did a rough clock, and this did seem to get the most amount of time in addition to the bipartisan theme, describing the border as a very dangerous place. Before I play a clip from the president, Chris, how accurate is this depiction?
I think it's a depiction that's come under a lot of criticism, whether it's in terms of, you know, the actual statistics on crime and who's committing it, number of border crossings, number of apprehensions, the state of the border, the danger or lack thereof posed by caravans, and those sorts of things. I think the administration has come under a lot of criticism and a lot of fire from those who have argued that these are not accurate depictions of what the state of life on the border is like.
So again, there's a lot of talk about the border by, 15, 16 minutes by my count. Again, that's a rough count. But I want to play a clip where the president, after describing, again, all these dangers that he sees there, murder and rape and drugs and mayhem, he described the border and immigration in terms of class, saying the wealthy and politically connected benefit from illegal immigration.
Meanwhile, working class Americans are left to pay the price for mass illegal immigration, reduced jobs, lower wages, overburdened schools, hospitals that are so crowded you can't get in, increased crime, and a depleted social safety net. Tolerance for illegal immigration is not compassionate. It is actually very cruel.
Andy, what'd you think about that, putting immigration in stark class terms?
Certainly, Donald Trump did well in 2016 by focusing on working class and the problems that the working class has had. And there is considerable evidence that illegal immigration depresses wages, especially among, if you look at the like the construction industries, service industries, and so forth. They're some areas they're dominated by people who are illegal workers. So there is that. Whether it's true in the sense that it hurts all of the working class is debatable, but there is certainly the perception out there, and all of these things in politics are a matter of the perception of what's going on, not necessarily the reality of it. And the perception, I think, will resonate and continue to resonate with those people that were supporting Trump in 2016.
Now, Andy, I want you to put on your pollster hat for a moment. An instant CBS poll, and who knows how accurate these are, but still, found 76% of Americans who tuned in approved of the speech, 24% disapproved. I just wonder, as a pollster, what you make of those numbers.
First off, I wouldn't pay much put much stock in an instant poll, number one. Secondly, the reason that you see that sort of support is that State of the Union addresses are watched by the party of the president. The other party largely tunes out. And you can see that going back for decades. During the Clinton administration, Democrats watched. During the Bush administration, Republicans watched. During the Obama administration, Democrats watched. And we're seeing the same sort of thing happening now. So essentially, the instant poll asked a bunch of Republicans, did you like what the Republicans said? And of course, they're going to say yes. The bigger thing about State of the Unions and public opinion is they almost never sway public opinion. There's essentially no impact from the State of the Union on public opinion in terms of measuring the president's job approval rating before and after. It's essentially, it's a Washington central event or a media centric event. It's really not something that the public really pays that much attention to or absorbs after it occurs.
Oh, I guess I've been in the news business too long because, of course, I watch these things and, you know, I take notes and I stay up late and all that. So it's a big event for the news media. But you're saying, Andy, these really don't matter much with the public at all.
According to Gallup, you know, you look back over the period from 2007 to 78 to 2014, the average impact of that was zero. So it just doesn't impact things much at all. And when it does, it's a percentage point or two, which is certainly within margins of sampling error.
That's really interesting. Chris Galdieri, you're a political scientist, so obviously you're interested in these. But what do you think about the point that Andy makes, that among the general public, these don't matter much?
Yeah, I think that's right. Presidents generally have a really hard time swaying public opinion. You know, what the public thinks about an issue or what they think of a given president really doesn't have that much to do with the words coming out of a president's mouth. They have to do with people's perceptions of the economy, the state of the world, America's place in it, and so on. Having said that, I think, you know, what matters about a State of the Union is it tells you what an administration's priorities are. It tells you what their agenda or what they want to get done in the coming year is. But I think looking at, you know, Trump's State of the Unions over the years, you know, what we see is a lot of big swings in the speeches that aren't necessarily followed up on very much. This is the second year he talked about the need for a big infrastructure bill. This year he talked about ending HIV in America by 2030. Now, I think that's a goal lots of people support, but, you know, it's an open question as whether that's going to be. Is that going to be Kennedy going to the moon, or is that going to be George W. Bush going to Mars, like he pledged in one of his State of the Unions, and then we never really heard that much about it. And I think one of the things we've seen with this White House is a tendency to talk about big goals, but not really have the policy framework to back those up after the speech.
Go ahead, Andy.
And I think that's the problem that the Trump administration has. Not only is he fighting Democrats in Congress, he's fighting his own party on many of the issues that he supports. The reason he wasn't able to get the border wall through and extend more restrictions on immigration is in part because a lot of Republicans are in favor of increased immigration, and they benefit, and the companies that they may represent benefit from illegal immigration into the country. So he's fighting a two-front battle there, and it's not, I think, to respond a little bit, it's probably not his fault that he can't get a lot of that stuff through. He probably can't get much of anything through, given the resistance he's going to get from his own party, let alone Democrats.
Just one more question for both of you on this point that, you know, although the media and political scientists focus on these speeches a lot, they don't really sway public opinion. It does seem like over the years, occasionally there's a phrase that kind of seeps into the public consciousness from these speeches. I'm thinking of George Bush's Axis of Evil, for example, or Ronald Reagan's, you know, Morning in America, although that was a commercial, I guess, not a State of the Union speech. But what do you think, Andy? Is there anything from this speech last night that kind of, even if people didn't sit and watch it like we all did, that might seep into the public consciousness in terms of, okay, this is what the Trump administration is all about?
Other than the border wall, which I think is just a reiteration of policies that he's been pushing for some time, the one thing I was struck by that may come up is his very adamant opposition to abortion and late-term abortion, which the Republican Party has kind of been downplaying those social issues for a while. That came up, and even Donald Trump really never was somebody who has been seen as a social conservative by any stretch of the imagination. that coming up in the wake of legislation passed in New York and in Virginia is something I think I'd pay attention to, because it may show some ability of Republicans to unify behind that and maybe divide Democrats a little bit.
A theme for 2020, then. Yeah. A couple other themes for 2020 that we should cover after a short break. Real quick, Chris, were you surprised also by that very strong anti-abortion language?
Well, I think it was outreach to an activist part of the Republican base that Trump needs to get reelected. He doesn't get reelected in 2020 if folks who are dedicated abortion opponents stay home.
All right. Well, coming up, more reaction, more clips from the speech, including some clips from the Democratic response. And we'll talk to New Hampshire young Republicans and young Democrats. We'll get your reaction, too. So send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477.
Civics 101 has done hundreds of shows about how the government works.
But we realized that we missed a step, something bigger.
All right, step right up, gentlemen. Don't miss your chance to commit treason.
Our nation, our government, is all built on paper and ink.
That's why we made a six-part series on the founding documents, the pieces of paper that make us us, or rather, we. Subscribe or listen online at civics101podcast.org. Civics 101 is a production of NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's a New Hampshire take on the president's State of the Union speech last night, where he outlined policies on a border wall, on the economy, a little bit on foreign policy, and other themes. We're hearing from Granite State analysts, and in just a moment, we'll hear from the state's Young Republicans and Young Democrats organizations. And of course, let's hear from you, too. Our number here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. With us now on the line is Ross Berry. He's treasurer for the New Hampshire Young Republicans. Ross, really nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm sure this was a big event for you and your group. Where did you watch the speech, Ross, and who were you watching with?
The party had a big get-together at a restaurant in Manchester last night. I watched it at home with my girlfriend via a streaming service, like a good millennial.
Okay. Sometimes people have these watch parties and so forth, and sometimes it's a quiet event in your sweatpants at home. So I appreciate that. What was your reaction, Ross, to the speech?
My reaction, I loved how the president outlined the successes the administration has had so far. You know, the State of the Union is a great opportunity for us as a party to kind of cut through the negative messaging that is pervasive in the media and talk about the important things that matter to the people. And one of the big things that resonated for me was the jobs. I believe you guys talked about it earlier. You know, it's the economy, stupid. The jobs are doing great. And I consider myself a middle-aged millennial. I graduated college right at the height of the recession. So I remember what it was like to be job hunting for the first time and see job postings for entry-level jobs that required 2 to 3 years of experience. And I'm excited to say that it's almost the complete opposite now. My company is having trouble hiring people. We can't find them. When people have jobs, they're contributing to the tax bases, they're buying homes, and they're living out the American dream. And I'm glad the president focused on that.
In addition to the economy, Ross, what was your biggest takeaway from this speech? Or if you were to write a headline about this, what would you say?
Kind of the secondary breakaway was the emphasis on foreign policy and the president's desire to end these what seems like endless wars. You know, I'm 29 years old, and the country has been ostensibly at war for almost two-thirds of my life. So I was glad on a personal level to hear that we're going to start considering our options in the Middle East.
Anything that surprised you, Ross?
I was surprised, and I believe Chris mentioned earlier that the president had brought up the abortion issue out of New York and most recently Virginia. He's correct. The party has tended to shy away from these issues in general. But I think what we see going on here nationally is very scary. And, you know, I know we have Dr. Smith with us today, who's a pollster expert. And I was just looking at the most recent Gallup poll from about June of last year, and it shows that only 13% of Americans think abortion should be legal in the last 3 months of the third trimester. So, you know, it was very interesting as a Republican to kind of see the party actually lead on this issue. It's normally an issue, you know, especially as a younger Republican, we tend to shy away from social issues. And this, that was something that kind of struck me as different.
Was there anything missing for you, Ross, where you thought, I kind of wish he said that?
You know, I'm a fiscal conservative through and through. So I was very pleased with it. You know, so long as we're talking about, you know, creating jobs, cutting regulations, keeping more money in people's pockets, I'm pretty happy.
The president mentioned the tax cut, and from a fiscally conservative standpoint, there have been estimates that this tax cut has hurt the nation's fiscal underpinnings. I wonder what you think about that.
I mean, I would love to see some spending restraints come with this. It's hard to get politicians in general to agree to spending cuts. And the biggest thing you need to know is what I call DC math. You know, when you do your budget at home, or when I do my budget at home, you know, I don't consider getting an automatic increase every year. I consider that I'm essentially going to make the same as next year. And if I make more, that's awesome. But in Washington, DC math, it's assumed that you're going to get an increase every year. So we can't even have conversations about stopping automatic increases. And it just goes to show that Washington is broken. I would love to see the budget get reined in. I would love to see the deficit get cut. You know, I'm a hardline fiscal conservative, but even I would consider changing cuts for a revenue increase. But that's never going to happen. You're always going to get one or the other. They're always going to increase spending, or they're going to cut taxes. And if I got to choose one or the other, I'm going to cut taxes.
So, but as a fiscal conservative, taking a line on the deficit and debt was not in the speech. Probably would have. Sounds like you would have liked to have heard that as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I know that's been a theme in some past State of the Unions. What about the long conversation about the border wall? The president describing the situation at the southern border in very dire terms. How did that hit your young Republican ears, Ross?
So it hit me on multiple levels. You know, I'm originally from Houston, Texas, so I was born and raised in a border state. I grew up around immigrants. Houston is an incredibly diverse city. And the big takeaway people need to understand about immigrations of all types, legal and illegal, is that the vast majority of people are coming here for their kids. They're not coming here for themselves. They're coming here they want their kids to have the American dream. So, but you do have to understand that when they come here, there are negative effects. The biggest thing that I take away is from a 2014 survey just released by the Census Bureau that shows that 63% of non-citizens in this country are on some form of welfare. Well, when that happens, that means that there's less resources available for the citizens here. And that and the policy of our party has always been to take care of American citizens first before we start taking care of other people. And it's just the cold, hard reality that we live in. There's only a fixed number of dollars to go around. And we can't continue to put our hands over our ears and act like this isn't happening.
One more question for you on the border wall and immigration, since that was a big theme in this speech. Multiple fact checkers this morning said the president's statements on the dangers at the southern border were either untrue or greatly exaggerated. How concerning is that to you, Ross, that the president gets up there and presents these items as facts when, in fact, many of them are not true?
Well, I would point to, you know, the recent busts at the border involving fentanyl and how that relates to here in New Hampshire. We obviously have a raging opioid epidemic, but in May of last year, there was a bust where they took down enough fentanyl that would have killed 28 million people, 26 million people here in America. So, you know, they can say what they want, and they can once again act like it's not happening, but it is very real. The drugs are coming up through our southern border. They're not, you know, there is a certain amount that comes in through airports. We have to concede that. We have to get that as well. But the vast majority of it is coming up through our southern border. And the fact that we were willing to shut down the government it's the first time in my young life I've seen Democrats not want to spend money. So I'm stunned that, you know, we can't even have basic conversations about securing our border and protecting our people, because it's not just, you know, we can have conversations about crime and welfare and all those other things. But the simple fact of the matter is they're using this incredibly porous Swiss cheese border to import literally tons of fentanyl and opioids that are killing Americans up here.
Well, and there's lots of fact-checking online, NPR, New York Times, Washington Post, and other sources. So we'll set that aside for the moment, but I think there will be some more discussion about this on the air on NPR and NHPR later today. In your role, last question for you, Ross, please, and again, you've been generous with your time. In your role as treasurer for the New Hampshire Young Republicans, if you could chat with the president for a few minutes, what advice would you give him to appeal to younger voters?
Yeah, actually, I think he hit on it, which is jobs, 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 jobs. Every one of my friends that I talk to, they are concerned about their jobs. And so long as we are going back to that bread and butter Republican issue, I believe we're going to be just fine. And if we get off of that messaging, the voters are going to respond as such.
Well, Ross, it's been good to talk to you, and we'll talk to you again.
Thank you so much.
That's Ross Berry. He's treasurer for the New Hampshire Young Republicans. We're now going to go to the president for the New Hampshire Young Democrats. Lucas Meyer is on the line. He's the president of that organization. And Lucas Meyer, it's good to have you, too. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Laura. Great to be on.
So did you watch the speech at home in your sweatpants or at a watch party somewhere?
We actually had a watch party over at Stark Brewing Company, where we had a group of young Democrats show up to watch not only the president's State of the Union, but more importantly, Stacey Abrams' incredible response.
Well, and we'll talk about her response a little bit later in the show. But what was your reaction, Lucas, to the president's speech and the reaction of the young people around you at the Stark Brewing Company?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty much what you would expect. No one was terribly shocked with what the president had to say. But I think really what excited a lot of people last night is that the Democratic Party has incredible, young, diverse leaders at the front of it, guiding our messaging, guiding our energy. And I think, you know, a lot of young people, not only in New Hampshire, but across the country, are being brought into the Democratic Party because we've been able to lift up these young leaders and really elevate them into a position where they're speaking to the issues most important to young people. And the party is taking those issues seriously. And we're starting to see the needle move on some of those issues. So, you know, it was the same old from the president. Some pretty divisive rhetoric. I mean, he made it pretty clear that we're heading for another shutdown, which is not encouraging. You know, we just had the longest shutdown in our country's history. A lot of our federal employees were furloughed over the holidays. And Stacey Abrams spoke to that, spoke to the struggle of those people over a complete political stunt that really would not benefit our country at all.
Ross Berry talked about, he was excited to hear the president talk about the economy. And when I asked him, you know, if you had the president's ear, what would you tell him to do to appeal to young voters? And he said he's already doing it, the economy. The economy is very good, Lucas. How do Democrats sort of counter that, those positive economic numbers that the president presented last night?
Look, I mean, especially right here in New Hampshire, I mean, we have an incredibly low unemployment rate, but we have a lot of companies that are looking to hire folks. And we're looking for innovative ways to stimulate our economy in New Hampshire to bring in those jobs for young people. And I think something that the president totally missed the mark on and did not speak to at all was, how do we tackle climate change? How do we create a clean energy economy for the future that can create a whole new wave of jobs for young people that not only are good paying jobs, but is good for our environment and good for everyone, really. Especially here in New Hampshire, you know, we are at the cusp of an incredible offshore wind revolution all up and down the East Coast. What are we going to do in New Hampshire to capitalize on that opportunity to create jobs here and really start to do the hard work it'll take to create the next generation workforce that New Hampshire needs?
Lucas, were there any elements of this State of the Union address that you liked, where you thought, oh, that sounds good to me?
Congresswoman Custer raising the roof was a particular highlight when he addressed all the incredible diverse number of women who have been elected into Congress. So I think that was the only highlight.
The only highlight? You didn't like criminal sentencing reform or paid family leave or college debt?
We have come to learn better from what the president says and what the president does. Obviously, we like to hear those things. We'd like to see some action. You know, the president talks about unifying the country, bringing people together, but then he bans transgender members of the military from serving. You know, that is a fundamental problem, and that sort of rhetoric, you know, and the actions he takes is having real impacts in our communities. So he said a lot of things, but what we'll be looking for is any action, and we are not holding our breath.
The president repeatedly called on members of Congress to work with him for the good of the country, for the common good. He invoked the upcoming anniversary of the D-Day invasion, saying, you know, look at the great things we can do when we work together. That was spread throughout this speech, really kind of bookending it at the front and at the end and in the middle. If Democrats block the president's proposed wall 100%, you know, will they look like the ones that are choosing party over country?
I do not believe so. The wall is a political tool that is being used to shut down the government for a partisan agenda. I know Ross was talking about, you know, a Swiss cheese border where there are a lot of drugs coming through, and he referenced a fentanyl bust. That bust happened at a port. That the wall on the border of Mexico would not have stopped those drugs from coming into our country. We should be focusing on ways to secure our borders, secure our ports of entry, secure our airports, but shutting down the government for a wall that will not tangibly help our country is not the answer.
You know, last question for you, Lucas, and I really appreciate your time. I asked Ross, you know, if you had the president's ear for 5 minutes, what would you tell him about appealing to young voters? Slightly different question for you. If you had the ear of young independent voters, you know, who maybe listened to the speech and said, yeah, border sounds pretty dangerous. Maybe we should tighten it up. And yeah, look at those economic numbers. It's pretty good. What's your message to young voters who may not be sure how they're going to vote next time around?
I think Stacey Abrams' address really encapsulated why young people are coming to the Democratic Party. Since 2017, 23% of young Republicans have come over to the Democratic Party because, you know, we are the party of inclusion. We're the party of economic and social justice. We're the party of diversity and opportunity and justice for all. And she really spoke to those issues very, very clearly. And I think this was a really unique State of the Union address because it really, unlike years past, really helped define the differences in the two parties. You know, right here in New Hampshire, you know, we helped elect 32 young people to the House. You know, we have the youngest majority leader in Dan Feltz, John Morgan, another young Dem in the Senate, Chris Pappas in Congress. You know, these are young people who are stepping up, who understand these issues and are able to communicate them to voters on both sides of the aisle and independent voters. So I was really proud of the speech Stacey Abrams gave. And I think it really painted a very clear picture why young people continue to come to the Democratic Party and the work we still have to do to continue to build that.
Well, Lucas, thank you for making time out. Again, I'm sure you were up late last night. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Lucas Meyer. He's state president for the New Hampshire Young Democrats. So, Chris and Andy, because this keeps coming up, especially in that last interview with Lucas of the Young Democrats, let's talk a little bit about Ms. Abrams and her her response to the State of the Union. First of all, Chris, why give these responses?
Well, I think if you're the party that does not hold the White House, you do not want to let a, you know, an hour plus of rhetoric from the president go unanswered. It's an opportunity to respond, to try to maybe promote a leader within your party or to otherwise, you know, just get your message, your talking points out into the conversation.
There was a lot of joking on social media yesterday and in mainstream media about the curse of the response, Democrat or Republican, depending on who's in the White House. Why is it cursed?
It's a terrible job. it's a really difficult to do these sorts of things well. If you are the president, you get the House chamber. It's full of Congress and the Supreme Court and generals in dress uniform. You get introduced by the sergeant at arms. It's all this pomp and pageantry, and then you can't replicate that. People who have tried often just look ridiculous. About 10 years ago, Bob McDonnell.
It's hard to find a good setting.
Yeah. He was the governor of Virginia, and I think he gave it from the Virginia State Legislature. And it just looked like, you know, a TV movie set that you'd use for Congress compared to the real thing.
Sometimes people do it in their offices all by themselves. Yeah, and
at least that's their office. Or, Bobby Jindal walking out of the governor's mansion in 2009, I think. You know, it's just... it's a really difficult thing to do well.
Go ahead, Andy. These things are they seem so canned, and that's no knock against anybody who does them, but nobody ever responds directly to what the president says. They've got this canned speech that they recorded, 3 days ago.
So I think that is right, because the president gets to set the tone of what's going to be said. He controls the agenda with the State of the Union address, and any response should be reactive to that agenda that he sets.
And these days, instant reaction on Twitter, people are very glib, and so...
Yeah, you'd expect...
Yeah, why not?
We expect that, but unfortunately... The people who are giving the response have their message that they want to try to use to counter the president, and they're going to give their speech rather than respond to what the president has, and that's fine because it does let them make a point. But for the viewer, it's the non sequitur between one group and the setting that the president has, and then the response.
It doesn't feel like a response.
It feels like it's coming out of left field. That it's like you turned the channel and you got a completely different program to watch.
Well, we got an email from Jill on that, and thank you, Jill. She says the real State of the Union message was given by Stacey Abrams last night. Heartfelt, compassionate, well thought out, passionate, and inspiring. In a word, Jill says, presidential. Jill, thank you for that. I do want to play a little bit from Stacey Abrams' State of the Union response, even though it wasn't directly a response still. This is Abrams talking about what she calls voter suppression. And in her speech, Abrams criticized Republican efforts around the country to tighten up voting rules and regulations.
Let's be clear. Voter suppression is real. From making it harder to register and stay on the rolls, to moving and closing polling places, to rejecting lawful ballots, we can no longer ignore these threats to democracy. While I acknowledge the results of the 2018 election here in Georgia, I did not, and we cannot, accept efforts to undermine our right to vote.
And just to remind us, Chris Gualtieri, please, who Stacey Abrams is for those people who were saying, oh, who's that?
Sure. She was the Democratic nominee for governor in Georgia last year. Prior to that, she was the House Minority Leader in the Georgia State Legislature. And this issue of voting and voting rights and voting suppression was a big controversy in her race, in part because her opponent was the Secretary of State of Georgia, who is in charge of many of those policies in the election where he was running for governor. So when changes came out about registration or polling places or voting times and that sort of thing, Abrams, and I think with some justification, looked at those and said these were really self-serving. These were attempts to change the rules to benefit his campaign.
Well, and as we talk about Democratic response, Morning Edition did interview U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen from New Hampshire this morning, a Democrat. And one of the things Senator Shaheen said, she was disappointed that the president didn't talk about the government shutdown. Stacey Abrams also talked about the government shutdown in her Democratic response. She criticized the president for his handling of this whole shutdown thing.
Making livelihoods of our federal workers a pawn for political games is a disgrace. The shutdown was a stunt engineered by the president of the United States, one that defied every tenet of fairness and abandoned not just our people, but our values.
Again, that's Stacey Abrams. She gave the Democratic response to the president's State of the Union address last night. Coming up after a short break, we'll take more of your comments. Jill, thank you for that email. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. Also, Chris and Andy, a couple more themes from the speech that I want to hit that you guys mentioned earlier. One is the role of women in our society, in the workforce, and in politics. Also, there was some foreign policy in this speech, including the president talking about Venezuela and North Korea, and getting the U.S. out of Middle Eastern wars. So we'll talk about all that in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. join me and a panel of experts in Nashua for a conversation on New Hampshire's opioid crisis. As part of NHPR's Crossroad Reporting Project, we take stock of where the state is now with this epidemic and what the future might be. Join us at the Nashua Public Library on February 7th at 6:30 p.m. Get your free tickets at nhpr.org/events.
This event is sponsored in part by Dartmouth Hitchcock.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, Sean Jasper is here, Commissioner of New Hampshire's Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. Send us your questions for Commissioner Jasper before the show to exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, New Hampshire reaction to President Trump's State of the Union speech. We welcome your comments. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange, or our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Chris Galdieri. He's an associate professor in the Department of Politics at St. Anselm College, and Andy Smith, director of the UNH Survey Center, the state's leading polling organization. Andy is also an associate professor of practice in political science. One more time, that phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, here's an email that came in from Ron. He says, fairness demands that the House act consistently and investigate Trump the same way it investigated Hillary Clinton. Now, before the speech, there was a lot of speculation. How much would the president talk about the ongoing investigations into his campaign and any possible ties to Russia, the Mueller investigation, and so forth? The president only really mentioned that once last night. I want to play that clip. He talked about the economy, how great it is, low unemployment, and we can do even better, he said. But then he gave this warning.
An economic miracle is taking place in the United States, and the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations. If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
Andy, what do you think? There was a lot of pre-speech speculation about would he set it aside like Bill Clinton did? Would he mention it a lot? He mentioned it a little.
Yeah, he kind of tossed that in there, and it was did seem out of place. He's talking about the economy and the strength of the economy, then all of a sudden saying, well, this isn't going to happen. And if you keep investigating me, as if the president or any president really has that much control of what happens with the economy or that any investigation is going to shut down the economy. So I thought it was an unusual way of framing it, but maybe that's for him, the economy is certainly the state of the economy is certainly the strongest thing that his administration has to point to going into the 2020 election. Maybe he's setting it up to, if it does go south, if the economy does go south the next couple of years, he has something to blame it on. But that's about the best that I can come up with an explanation for throwing it in that way.
What's the political risk or benefit, Andy, of putting it in that economic warning and calling it ridiculous?
I don't think there's really much risk. I mean, the country is so divided on this, Democrats and
Republicans. People have already decided how they feel.
Yeah, there's two completely different narratives that are going on about what's going on with the Mueller investigation, and I don't think this is going to influence that one way or the other.
Chris, you want to give us your thoughts on that as well?
Yeah, I also think there's an element of that being, a threat that he's not going to follow through on. I mean, the idea of, stop investigating me or the economy gets it. The economy is what he's got going for him. If he gets reelected in 2020, it will be because the economy is in a really good place. I mean, frankly, the State of the Union moment it reminded me most of was Richard Nixon back in the day declaring that 1 year of Watergate was enough. And, well, that didn't work out too well for him.
Well, there was you mentioned 2020, and we keep sort of occasionally circling back to that because there are the themes that are being put out there in this speech. As you gentlemen both know, in 2018, Republicans did less well among women, especially suburban women, many of whom voted for President Trump, but some of whom turned to Democrats in the midterms. And a couple times in this speech, the president highlighted what he called the achievements, the progress of American women. And in a lighter moment, he highlighted the number of American women in the workforce, which prompted many of the newly Democratic women, who were all dressed in white, to stand and cheer. And then that seemed to catch the president off guard a little bit, but he caught up very quickly. Let's hear.
Don't sit yet. You're going to like this. And exactly one century after Congress passed the constitutional amendment giving women the right to vote, we also have more women serving in Congress than at any time before.
So, Andy, he's right. A lot of women serving in Congress, seeming to take credit for all those women in Congress.
Well, he might be able to take credit for this one, because certainly the Democrats who won in 2018, the women who won, were often there because of their opposition to Donald Trump. So he can claim credit for helping them get elected by just being the president. But, you know, this is something that Republicans have been having a difficult time with for a long time. It used to be in the 1970s, 80s, and even into the 1990s that highly educated, more suburban women were a core group of the Republican Party. And that has shifted over time. And now we see that college-educated women are some of the strongest supporters of Democrats, not only for president, but also in these in midterm elections. And I think we saw that the turnout is high among that group, and they came out and voted in 2018.
What about the women in the audience, Chris, kind of making this show, Democratic women kind of standing together, all dressed in white?
Well, a couple things. One is that it was pretty clear that did catch Trump off guard. And it's striking to me that usually when you're writing the State of the Union in the White House, you think about, OK, what are the possible, you know, sarcastic responses to this? What are the possible unintended responses to this? And clearly nobody had thought along those lines.
That the reason that, there are more women is because of the anti-Trump
vote in
2018?
Or that they might take that as an invitation to, you know, give a standing ovation that was not expected or welcome at that point in the speech, that sort of thing. But it's also striking that if you look at the raw number of women in Congress, the number has increased. But that increase has been entirely because of Democratic women. The number of Republican women in Congress actually went down after the 2018 elections last year. And so, you know, we're talking a lot about how polarized our parties are ideologically. If, you know, this might be the beginning of our parties also polarizing a bit along gender lines, which is a really interesting place to be.
Well, that's why it's good to have you here, Andy, because you've been looking at these numbers for a long time. I mean, in general, just slightly, correct me if I'm wrong, men have more tended to vote Republican and women more Democrat, just slightly.
Yeah, that's been the case in recent decades.
You talked about the gender gap in politics.
Prior to Ronald Reagan, men tended to vote more Democratic because of the, kind of the working man's line of the Democratic Party. That shifted quite a bit, and as a Democratic coalition has shifted to more group-based, certainly the culture wars with abortion and women's rights have pushed many women towards the Democratic Party, and that's that has stayed in place. But I think the key difference, though, is if you look at married women versus unmarried women, is a stark difference, where unmarried women are very strong supporters of Democrats. Married women, it's not so much the case, and married women in this 2016 election actually voted for Trump by a slight majority voted for Trump. So it's shifting, but it's not just as stark as men versus women. There are subsets within that division that are more interesting, I think, to watch.
Sure. Well, a couple more themes to hit with you guys before we close out, and there's so much more that we could talk about. But two more things in particular. Last week, we did a show looking at 2 years of President Trump and his policies' impact on New Hampshire. We looked at health care. We looked at the economy, trade, the environment. And we heard from several listeners during the show who said we should have also talked about a rise in racial and ethnic hatred, tension and violence, which they felt was attributable to the president. Now, in his speech last night, the president spent about 6 minutes talking about the attacks in Pittsburgh against the Tree of Life synagogue. Let's hear what he had to say, making a pretty strong statement against anti-Semitism in this country.
We must never ignore the vile poison of anti-Semitism or those who spread its venomous creed. With one voice, we must confront this hatred anywhere and everywhere it occurs.
So, Chris Galdieri, what did you think of that? This vile poison of anti-Semitism, stand against it, and those who spread its creed? That's a pretty clear statement.
It is. It is. And I think it was one of the most conventional parts of the State of the Union. It seems like a part of the speech that you can imagine, someone like one of the other Republicans who ran in 2016 or, past president giving. But I also think it taps into this vein of nostalgia that's run through Trump's entire campaign, from his slogan, Make America Great Again, to lionizing blue-collar workers, to talking about things like the D-Day invasion, things like the moon landing, all these things that are sort of, part of that, baby boomer cultural narrative. And I think that that's something that Trump has really spoken to throughout, since he became a candidate in 2015.
What do you think, Andy?
I think this also points to the influence of people within his administration and his family. Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, is Jewish. His daughter converted to Judaism. So this is something I think that is important to him personally. And we know that both of those two are influential in his policy decision-making. It also, I think, points to some of the divisions that are coming up within the Democratic Party, particularly with the movement to ban trade with Israel because of the treatment of Palestinians. And that's becoming stronger and stronger in the Democratic Party. They call it the BSD movement. And I think that's something that maybe he's trying to tap into that, because I don't know. I want to say it's anti-Semitic, but it's certainly perceived as anti-Semitic by some people within the country.
And he did mention that he had officially designated Jerusalem as the official capital of Israel. So an attempt to maybe peel off some Jewish voters towards Republicans.
And Jewish voters have been very strong supporters of the Democratic Party going back to FDR or before. And maybe he sees this as an opportunity. It's not so much that the Jews in America are a very large voting bloc. It's a fairly small percentage of the population, but they are very influential in politics and business world, and I think this may be an opportunity for him to see a way of getting some support there.
Well, and the president did get dinged after the Charlottesville riots, Andy, where there were, anti-Semitic slogans and so forth, and one woman died, and so perhaps this was his attempt to kind of state it more broadly than he had after the Charlottesville riots. He got in trouble for what he said.
Yeah, the Charlottesville one, that I think is probably more racial component with Charlottesville. But the anti-Semitism and pro-Israeli aspect of his administration has been really quite strong, certainly in comparison with the Obama administration, maybe even to the Bush administration.
So foreign policy, we have barely touched it, gentlemen. And there were some elements of foreign policy. Some Democrats last night said they liked the fact that the president said, too many years in these Middle Eastern wars, time to get out, time to go. How did you interpret that, Chris Galdieri?
I thought it was striking coming from a Republican. Time was that someone speaking like that would have been, denounced by the Bush White House and that sort of thing. So it shows you how times change.
It's like weak on foreign policy.
Exactly, exactly.
Weak on terrorism.
That would be the mildest response to it, I think. but I think this is one of those areas where, it reminded me a bit of the Trump of 2015, who often took these positions that were counter to Republican orthodoxy on things like foreign policy.
And trade.
Trade. Even, as a candidate, he talked about raising taxes on the wealthy. He hasn't done that in office, obviously. But it did strike me as interesting in those terms. And, I think it will be interesting to see whether he can follow through on that or whether he sees a lot of pushback. For instance, when he announced a withdrawal from Syria a while back, there was tons of blowback from the Pentagon, from the foreign policy establishment, from Republicans in Congress, as well as some Democrats.
Well, and when he talked about that, getting out of, these long foreign wars as a candidate, a lot of people said, wow, he and Bernie Sanders are kind of talking about the same thing. So he definitely mentioned it last night, getting possibly out of Afghanistan. He talked about Syria and Iraq. Speaking of Senator Sanders, every single TV station that aired this panned on Senator Sanders when President Trump said this. Let's hear.
Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free.
Okay, Andy. So socialism in a State of the Union speech, it actually wasn't completely out of context. It came after the president talked about all the political troubles in Venezuela.
And he also said the U.S. will never be a socialist country. This is, again, I think pointing out positioning himself for the 2020 election. We've seen in the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders doing extremely well in 2016, and several young Democrats, Ocasio-Cortez out of New York, essentially advocating much, much more socialistic parties, positions and moving the Democratic Party to the left. I think he's trying to paint the Democratic Party as a leftist, quasi-socialist party with, Bernie Sanders is certainly an example of that, a former socialist, and it gives him an opportunity to position himself as the anti-socialist going into the 2020 election.
So you weren't too surprised by that mention of socialism will never be socialist?
I was not necessarily surprised, but that was actually probably the best timed part of the speech in the sense that he was able to make a political point and attack the Democrats without having to say that he's attacking Democrats. And he had the crowd cheering as he was leading up to it. So that was, I think, for just rhetorical trick, it worked really well.
Tying it to Venezuela, but at the same time warning people about Democrats' economic
Absolutely.
Policies. Well, guys, we could talk a lot longer, but just one last question for you, and it's more a theatrics question. Chris, the use of people who represent certain causes. Mm-hmm. All presidents have done this in recent years. Now our members of Congress do it. Everybody has a special guest who represents some aspect of some issue they want to highlight. Did President Trump use this any more than other presidents have? And how effectively did he use these people?
I think he used it about
as much. Pretty impressive stories, by the
way. Yes, absolutely. And I think he used it about as much and about as impressively as most White Houses do. And I think it is a way to sort of get the crowd on your side when these are, here's a heroic veteran or a child who overcame cancer and these sorts of things. I mean, they're generally people that it is very hard for a member of Congress to not stand and applaud. And I think it's sort of using the pageantry of the event to your advantage.
Well, it was interesting too, Andy. Two of the people who were highlighted and applauded quite vigorously were people who'd been in prison, and the president used this as a way to promote criminal justice reform.
Well, that's one of the achievements of his administration, bipartisan criminal justice reform that just passed. So that's an opportunity for him to not only tout his party or his policies, but to maybe help heal some of the divisions within African Americans and him particularly.
All right. Guys, we could have talked a lot longer. I really appreciate you being here, staying up late last night watching, coming in early this morning. Andy Smith, it was good to see you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That's Andy Smith. He is director of the UNH Survey Center, also an associate professor of practice in political science. Chris, thank you also. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Chris Galdieri. He's an associate professor in the Department of Politics at St. Anselm College. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, and Ali Oshinsky. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our conversation always continues online at Facebook and at nhpr.org. I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.